Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. It is Thursday, May 10th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. Got a great show for you here today. We'll speak with Professor Mark Lamont Hill from Temple University in Philadelphia about snitching. Dr. Hill has a book out about the subject, and we'll get a chance to talk to him about that. First up on the program today, we have news from Normal. Our news today, medical marijuana issue heard by British Columbia Supreme Court. This week, a constitutional challenge of the Canadian Federal Medical Cannabis Program is being heard in the Supreme Court of British Columbia. In May of 2004, the Vancouver Island Therapeutic Cannabis Research Institute, a research and cultivation facility overseen by the Victoria Island Compassion Society, was raided by the West Shore Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Two employees were charged with multiple counts of cannabis production, and over 900 plants were seized and destroyed, temporarily leaving the critically and chronically ill member of the VICS without a safe source of medicine. The ensuing court case and constitutional challenge is taking place from May 9th to the 18th in British Columbia and could establish that the Canadian Federal Medical Cannabis Program is violating the constitutional rights of critically and chronically ill Canadians by unnecessarily restricting access to the program, supplying an inadequate source of cannabis, and instituting arbitrary limitations on production and distribution. Quote, "This ineffective, onerous, and expensive program has long been an impediment to safe access," close quote, says Philippe Lucas, a medical cannabis user and founder of the Victoria Island Compassion Society. The VICS legal team consists of Mr. John Conroy of Abbotsford, British Columbia, and Mr. Kirk Toussaint. Witnesses for the defense include Senator Pierre-Claude Nolin, chair of the Senate Special Committee on Illegal Drugs, Dr. Robert Melamed, biology professor at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. If successful, this challenge will make the legal medical use of cannabis more accessible and potentially legalize the community-based distribution of cannabis. A similar challenge in Ontario from 2003 resulted in the court striking down the prohibition on recreational adult use for cannabis in Ontario, thereby legalizing the personal use of cannabis for over 18 months. This case could lead to a similar outcome in British Columbia. Also here on the program today, in light of the recent Republican debates on MSNBC and co-sponsored by Politico.com, it was kind of clear, at least from what I saw out there, as well as the voting received on MSNBC's website, that Congressman Ron Paul of Texas won that Republican debate, and it was a pretty striking debate, actually. Dr. Paul has appeared right here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash, so in light of him winning that Republican debate, I thought we'd revisit his interview here today. Here's Congressman Ron Paul interviewing here on the Audio Stash. Here on the Audio Stash, we're going to highlight members of the U.S. Congress with interviews about their thoughts and work regarding marijuana. Joining us today for our congressional highlight is Representative Ron Paul of Texas. Congressman Paul is a Republican who represents Texas's 14th District, and he's co-sponsored an annually proposed bill regarding medical marijuana access for all Americans. Mr. Paul has accepted donations from the Normal PAC and has appeared at press conferences for the medical marijuana bill with Normal's founder Keith Strupp. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Congressman Ron Paul to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today. Congressman, thanks again for taking time to join us during this busy week. First, you're a medical doctor, and tell us about your thoughts on medical marijuana and how you see it being used.
Well, although I'm a physician, I don't have any personal experience with it. From what I can read and learn about it, I think it's very beneficial. I look at this this project, so to speak, in two ways, one the political and one the medical, and I have no qualms about people wanting to use it if they use good judgment. Politically, I feel very strongly that in all cases of medication, whether it's marijuana or any other holistic choice that they'd like to make, the people in a free society ought to be able to make that choice.
Congressman, how does it make you feel when you hear about the DEA raiding medical marijuana facilities in California that operate under state law there and in many cases operate under local county regulations as well?
To me, it's an outrage. They may well be denying some people a great deal of comfort, because nutrition is so important when somebody is suffering from cancer or chemotherapy, and if you can get the nutrition into them, they may well extend their survival. But the other attack here is not only encroachment on these personal choices, but the principles of states' rights and what was set up originally in our Constitution, that these problems that develop and there are conflicts, that they should always be settled at the state level. Because under those conditions, if you make a mistake, it's only in one state. When you make it at the national level, as the DEA will and has, then that hurts everybody, and they have violated the whole principle of the republic that we're supposed to be defending.
And what kinds of reactions do you get for just bringing up this debate about marijuana as a medicine?
It's been used against me in every campaign since 1996. And they spend a lot of money on it. I thought it would go away, but in 96, there were three main campaigns that I was involved in, an election and a runoff and then a general election, and both Republicans and Democrats spent a lot of money using this issue against me, and yet me just sticking to the principles that I've just spoken of, I was always able to win the elections in spite of the fact I'm in a very religious Bible Belt type of community. So I think there's a lot more understanding about this issue than people realize. And I thought maybe they wouldn't even bring it up again, but this past election, it was brought up again, and it probably gained me votes mainly because I think it was used in an ugly manner. You know, if you're for this, you're a terrible person. And that more or less this time backfired on them because as a physician and a parent and a grandparent, I don't think the people in my district believe that I would ever do anything deliberately to hurt people.
And Congressman, we have to mention here that you're not just any type of MD, but an OBGYN, and you've delivered thousands of babies. So coming from that standpoint, few could argue your concern for young people.
That is right, and I think that helped me as well.
Also, Congressman Paul, I have to ask about this political climate we live in today. On one hand, we have the DEA raiding medical marijuana facilities in California. On the other, we have you as a Republican continuing to get elected, even with your opponents using the medical marijuana issue as a mudslinging issue. But do you see the attitudes in Washington beginning to shift so that we could see some federal change on this topic?
I think it's changing in America, and I think the people are way ahead of the Congress. I think Congress will probably wake up, and there'll be a I know it's gradual. It seems to be gradual now, and it seems frustrating to many of you who have promoted this. I think that these kind of events occur in a climactic way, and all of a sudden, just throw in the towel. And I think this is what has happened in the past, and we may be approaching that. Almost like, yes, you have to be for the war, or if you're not, you're unpatriotic. And finally, the people wake up and send a message. And now there's a lot of people in Washington aren't so anxious about supporting the war. You know, they're running for cover. And that may happen, with the whole issue of drugs. I mean, it certainly happened with alcohol. There was a movement and a demand for prohibition, and then all of a sudden they saw all the consequences. To me, we're in a much more difficult time because at least back when they tried to prohibit alcohol, they recognized that the Constitution had to be changed and the government had no authority. Now, we live in an age where generation after generation have come to accept the fact that the courts and the federal government has this responsibility to take care of us, you know. So they don't have as much respect for the Constitution, and yet I still am optimistic enough to believe that we are a free enough society that information will finally get out there and the people will finally say enough is enough.
Well, that is certainly very heartening to hear. Congressman, I really want to thank you again for taking time to join us here today on Normal's Podcasting.
Very good. Good to be with you.
Congressman Ron Paul represents the 14th District in Texas. We have links to his website at normalaudiostash.com. That was our previous interview with Congressman Ron Paul here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash, and looking forward to speaking with him again very soon here on the program. Now let's get to this very cool piece of music. This guy, Human Revolution, he tours around the country. Got links to his website. It's thehumanrevolution.org. They have a cool song called Tree of Life, which we're going to play here on the Audio Stash tomorrow. But when I was getting that song today, I noticed this one up on their website. With the political season being the way it is, I thought this was a great song to play today. This is The Human Revolution.
Well, don't blame me, you voted for Willie. If Willie was elected, we'd all get shrilly. The foreigners would love the USA. He passed peace pipe all around. Good voter turnout in every town to vote Willie for president of the United States. Well, Willie wouldn't bomb no countries royal. Keep American troops on American soil. Maybe peace would finally get somewhere. For his inauguration, he just smoked a joint. Don't need no speech to make his point. Legalize our freedom everywhere. Well, don't blame me, boy, for Willie. If Willie was elected, we'd all get shrilly. Then foreigners would love the USA. He'd pass the peace pipe all around. Good voter turnout in every town. To vote Willie Nelson for president of the United States. He'd feed everybody with a cup and spoon. Cornbread, greens, and honeysuckle rose. With Bobby and the boys playing in the band, he'd introduce his new economic plan and the State of the Union with a good old country show. Well, don't blame me, you voted for Willie. If Willie was elected, we'd all get shrilly. And foreigners would love the USA. He'd pass the peace pipe all around. Good voter turnout in every town to vote Willie for president of the United States. With Waylon and Merle in his cabinet, he'd clear up all of his tax bullshit. Maybe send some money down the Appalachian Way. Have a big old party down in Tennessee. Finally set this country free. Lord, he'd show us all an unclouded day. Oh, land of cloudless days. Oh, land of an unclouded sky. Yeah, he'd show us all a place where no mushroom clouds rise. Lord, he'd show us all an uncloudy day. Well, don't blame me, you voted for Willie. If Willie was elected, we'd all get shrilly. The foreigners would love the USA. He'd pass a peace pipe all around. Good voter turnout in every town. Willie for president of the United States.
That was the Human Revolution with Don't Blame Me, I Voted for Willie Nelson there. Fellow Texan, great stuff going on there in Texas. Ron Paul, Willie Nelson. There are good things from Texas, folks, believe me. Next up today, let's speak with Dr. Mark Lamont Hill from Temple University in Philadelphia.
Today on the Audio Stash, we're going to talk about the topic and phrase of snitching. The term has quickly become mainstream, but both the word and concepts evolved in urban hip-hop cultures across America. Joining us today is Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, one of America's leading hip-hop intellectuals and assistant professor of urban education at Temple University in Philadelphia. Dr. Hill, welcome to the program today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again for joining us. You recently wrote a piece called A Treatise on Snitching, which I found fascinating as it highlighted the moral and ethical struggle involved. You know, first let me ask, what kinds of misconceptions of snitching do you see out there right now in America?
I think the biggest misconception, two big misconceptions surround this idea of snitching. One is that it is a historically unique circumstance or practice. That is that the hip-hop generation in particular has begun to engage in something that is not connected to a broader and longer tradition. The second thing is that an anti-snitching position is viewed solely as a rejection of civic responsibility, as opposed to perhaps a more complicated, complex, nuanced, and principled response to a set of historical and current legal circumstances that demand a different type of response.
So when faced with the situation of having to snitch, where does our loyalty go first?
Well, it depends. Many people are taught, particularly people who are on the margins of society, gays, lesbians, poor people, black people, many immigrant populations, many people are taught to side with the state. It's ingrained in all Americans, in fact, in many ways, to side with the state, to trust the state, to trust the government, to trust authority. I mean, from the moment you enter school, you're taught to give a certain type of respect and deference to authority figures. The problem is, particularly for people on the margins of society, authority figures aren't always acting in the best interest of the people. And so many people, in spite of the fact that these state apparatuses aren't operating in their best interest, still go to them. Other people recognize the fact that those government institutions or those authority figures or those structures more broadly are not acting in their best interest, and they side with other social commitments. For example, Lil' Kim made a decision to side with her crew, with the people who associated with her, the people who supported her, the people who she loved, as opposed to siding with the state, even though the odds are stacked against her. Many gang members, and even if you look at Tukey Williams before he passed, one of the conditions that prevented many people, and Arnold Schwarzenegger owned up to this, you know, one of the things that prevented people from granting him clemency was the fact that he refused to, quote-unquote, snitch on many of the activities that his gang had participated in. So he made a certain type of commitment that was, in his estimation, and mine too, morally sound.
So this is a huge decision that an individual has to make. And, you know, frankly, many say that, you know, stop snitching might be an easy route, but it certainly is. You point out Tukey, he certainly took the hard route, and the hard route that came with staying silent.
Exactly. It's often, not always, but often a very, very difficult decision to make, because whenever you snitch, whenever you tell someone else's business, there's a politics around it, and there's an ethical dilemma and a moral quagmire that inevitably emerges that must be resolved by forcing a person to choose between two competing social commitments, two competing value systems, two competing authorities. And making that decision is always a difficult one, or usually a difficult one.
So, you know, why is it that people will decry a Tukey or Lil Kim for staying silent, but those same attitudes are not in place for a reporter like a Judith Miller or, say, White House Politicos, who are nearly applauded for the same behavior? You know, why is it that people view this white-collar, so to say, non-snitching so different than when people in urban hip-hop culture stay silent?
One is because people don't presume that the hip-hop generation has the type of critical reflection and moral authority to make those types of decisions. So people from the beginning assume that if Judith Miller is willing to sit in a cell, that if Judith Miller is willing to sacrifice her career to defend Scooter Libby, that it must be moral, it must be ethical, it must be principled, it must be reflective, it must be quite thoughtful of her to do such a thing, whereas no one gives that type of legitimacy to Busta Rhymes or Lil' Kim from the gate. And that's not about those individuals, it's about the hip-hop generation, and more particularly about hip-hop culture, and its ostensible lack of critical reflection, moral authority, and intellectual acuity. We know that that's not the case, but that's often what's ascribed to us. So just from the base, people don't assume that they could even be thinking about those issues. But also, there's a certain sense that certain authorities should demand a certain type of deference, such as the police. So no one wants a stop-snitching posture to affect police work, whereas they may not be as reluctant to see stop good on journalism or a different type of police work. For example, with Judith Miller, there were different issues at stake, and so people, I think, were more than willing to concede that to her. Whereas when people are getting killed on the street, when you have gun violence, and this is a legitimate critique, when you have gun violence and people dying in the hood every day, there's a different type of prioritization that goes on. People say, look, you can have these principles, but people are dying, and we need to make some decisions about that. And I think that is also a legitimate thing to consider.
Dr. Hill, it seems in some ways, and this is, you know, just an opinion, that the moral and ethical fabric of the individual cultures in America, like urban hip-hop culture, perhaps have built a stronger moral fabric within themselves.
Well, in some areas, yes, but I don't want to romanticize or overestimate, you know, the accuracy of hip-hop culture's moral compass either. I mean, when you really think about someone like the Busta Rhymes case, where it doesn't seem to me there is this moral impulse or this ethical impulse. It's more about protecting his career. It's more about protecting a certain sense of masculinity. I'm not a snitch, and perhaps even a selfish sort of thing where he's scared of the repercussions of it. That's not necessarily morally ethically sound, and it's no more principled than I would say some of George Bush's demands for silence from members of his administration. So I don't want to always say that, and not just on a celebrity level, but also on a day-to-day level. Much of the stop snitching calls that have been made within neighborhoods have degenerated into don't be a witness, don't be responsible. When you see an old woman get knocked over the head and her pocketbook taken, don't say anything. And the idea of saying anything has become anathema to people in the hood sometimes. And that is equally problematic. So again, I don't want to make it seem as if hip-hop generation has it all figured out and we're just misunderstood. In many ways, the commodification of this anti-snitching or stop-snitching position has resulted in a watering down of the message and an inversion of the value such that it doesn't necessarily mean what it used to and it doesn't necessarily stand for anything positive anymore.
And I was amazed in your article about the parallels, really, between urban hip-hop culture and big American politics, particularly when it comes to this idea of wet and dry snitching. And tell us a little bit about these two strains of snitching.
Well, dry snitching, to me, in many ways, reflects some of the ethical and moral dilemmas that emerge when a person has to decide what type of storytelling and perhaps even truth-telling they're going to participate in public and private, maybe even counter-public spaces. In other words, dry snitching is about what happens when you snitch without snitching, when you tell on someone indirectly. The hip-hop community often talks about people who talk indirect, people who say things indirectly. Dry snitching emerges from prison culture. In prison culture, there are moments where you are forced to fight or someone provokes you to fight. Because of the consequences of backing down from a fight, a person has to be creative and find other ways to get out of that fight. And so one of the things the person would do is to yell back at the person, to wolf back, and to wolf back so loudly that a guard would hear them. And then the guard would come over and break up the fight, and thereby saving the person who was initially scared. That's a way of calling, but he didn't call the guard. He did something to call the guard's attention. So that's what dry snitching comes from. Also, there's a sexual connotation to it, obviously, wet versus dry, and what that might mean in terms of the anatomy. But when you think about dry snitching in that context, you now think about people who tell on people without positioning themselves as snitches. That's what happens when a rapper like 50 Cent comes out and makes a song implicating a whole bunch of New York's underworld. That's what happens when Kobe Bryant gets under police custody and immediately, for no good reason, implicates Shaq and saying that Shaq did certain things that he perhaps should not have done that were not illegal but perhaps immoral, not as a way of getting out of the crime but as a way of perhaps developing a certain type of camaraderie with the police, but also surely knowing that it would get out and therefore would tell on Shaq. You have these tell-all novels. We could think of Jose Canseco. We could think of Karin Steffens. We could even think on some level of Terrell Owens' latest book, where he talks about certain things that happened behind the scenes in the locker room that historically have remained silent within hip-hop, in football culture. All of these things are moments of dry snitching, where your intention isn't to snitch, supposedly, but you end up telling other people's business. And the problem with dry snitching, of course, is that you've now made a choice to not honor a particular commitment that you made, either implicitly or explicitly. For example, with Karin Steffens, who wrote a book called Confessions of a Video Vixen, she tells this cautionary tale wherein she acknowledges that she had sex with all these celebrities. Now, she's decided to get religion and tell the truth about her sexual encounters. But what she's also done is break this code of secrecy that she established with all these celebrities, many of whom were married. Now, one could argue that that is an immoral position that she took or that they took in the first place. That might be true, but again, there's a dilemma there. Do you honor the first commitment you made, or do you honor the second one that you decided to make? That's dry snitching, and that's some of the issues that emerge. Wet snitching is less about the ethical. I mean, it's about ethical issues, but it's more essentially concerned, I think, with the ghetto snitching industry for me, and the ways in which snitches, government informants, government paid storytellers, are used to replace legitimate historic police work to handle prosecutions in a much more expeditious but not necessarily efficient manner, and to herd a whole bunch of black and Latino bodies into the prison industrial complex. Wet snitching is when you make the decision to act as a paid or otherwise compensated informant for the government. Currently, one out of four black, well really one out of three, somewhere between one out of three, one out of four, young black men are under criminal supervision right now between the ages of 20 and 29. It's no surprise then that one out of 12 currently function as snitches within the community, usually in exchange for reduced criminal liability more so than money, and continued police protection. But that's a very, very dangerous circumstance, because now suddenly when you think about nightclubs, when you think about bars, when you think about community spaces, to know that one out of 12 black men are currently operating as snitches, you have to consider the consequences of that in terms of fragmenting community, destroying trust, not just between community and police, but between community members and other community members, not to mention invasion of privacy issues. Now, the counter-argument, to be sure, is, well, if they're not doing anything wrong, they have nothing to worry about. But we know, historically, that argument has never held up, that violation of civil liberties from McCarthyism through COINTELPRO right on now through the NSA's most recent activities, none of that stuff holds up supports an argument that says that if you do nothing wrong, you'll be just fine, because people who do nothing wrong all the time are implicated. The U.S. has historically developed enemies lists based on some of the information that's developed through these things. But in black and Latino communities, it's even more vicious, because people aren't just being placed on lists. They're being herded into prisons. And of course, we know that we can't necessarily rely on the information provided by snitches, so it's not even accurate information, which, again, I think undermines the claim that if you don't do anything wrong, you have nothing to worry about. Lastly, when you look at people who are wrongfully killed, you know, 40% of people who die, through capital murder, through the electric chair, lethal injection and such, 40% of the people who die wrongfully are killed through, or are prosecuted, are found guilty, more specifically, through snitch information or misinformation. So it's a thoroughly dysfunctional system that, in the name of effectiveness and efficiency, has ultimately undermined the integrity of the whole process and sacrificed the lives of a whole bunch of black and Latino bodies. That's wet snitching, and that's a critical issue, and that is the predicate for the hip-hop generation's critique of snitching.
That was an incredible number to encounter in your article, the 1 in 12 being informants. You know, are all of these informants paid?
To be clear, it's 1 in 12 between 20 and 29, according to Alexandra Nadipoff's most recent study. She's a law professor out at Loyola. It's 1 in 12 between 20 and 29 years old. But they're not all paid informants. Most people who act as informants, in fact, do it in exchange for reduced criminal liability. You get picked up on a drug. You get picked up on a drug charge. Instead of getting prosecuted, you agree to remain in your community and make controlled drug buys for once a month, and to report any other illegal activity that goes on. The problem is, of course, again, that people are going to lie and give misinformation, but also people aren't necessarily going to snitch on the right people. So instead of the big fish getting snitched on by the little fish, thereby eliminating the drug trade, for example, because that's really what this started around, oftentimes the big fish becomes a snitch and snitches on the hand-to-hand drug deals on the corner, which doesn't eliminate the trade. It just keeps it alive, in fact. Also, the snitch may say your girlfriend leaves you and she gets a new boyfriend. You may end up snitching on him because he's stealing cable and selling small amounts of marijuana out the back of the house. One could argue that that's illegal, too, and should be prosecuted, but not at the expense of the larger drug dealers, which is what's happening.
Dr. Hill, let's go back to a point you mentioned earlier. You know, how can urban communities bring themselves back from this epidemic of wet snitching and the stop snitching rhetoric? How can they bring themselves back to being true citizen witnesses?
I think the first thing that is required is a certain acknowledgement, and because part of this is a generational issue, a certain acknowledgement that the hip-hop generation's critiques are legitimate, that there is some legitimacy to the position in the first place. And by acknowledging the fact that many people are acting as informants and that many people are engaged in a principled response, the community can then begin to have a certain type of conversation about snitching, a certain type of conversation. That's the first thing. The second thing is that communities need to begin to police each other in ways that we historically have. There are a whole host of reasons that particularly black and Latino communities aren't policing themselves in the same way. One is a greater influx of people who don't own homes. There's, again, greater intervention of police. There's the labor issues. There are a whole host of issues why people are broken up that we can't get into all today. But the fact is that the community need to come together and organize and find ways to police themselves so that there's a desire to protect the lives of an 80-year-old woman who gets robbed in broad daylight. That's a problem. But the community needs to have a sense of community in order to acknowledge it as a problem. Also, we can't merely engage in sort of self-help, Bill Cosby-esque position that reduces the responsibility and liability of the state itself. So we need to also, in addition to policing ourselves and being more responsible, we need to also demand different types of protections for people who do step up. And the fact is, in no city in America is there a witness protection program. That's TV, you know, where you tell and then the police protect you. I mean, there are witness relocation programs where they'll force you out of your community. There are programs that will, you know, that will protect you until you go to trial. But once you go to trial, that's it. It's not uncommon in Philadelphia. Just, you know, a few weeks ago, someone's house was firebombed after they did the responsible thing and witnessed. So we need to install some sort of protection. Now, we know logistically it's impossible for the police to protect everyone who testified. But again, we need to create mechanisms that demand more from those people meaning the police and other government authority figures. That, I think those are key issues that will promote witnessing, but also on the popular culture end, that I would love to see some critical issues. I mean, can you imagine the significance of Jay-Z saying, "I'm no snitch, but I'll be a witness"? That kind of position that Jay-Z could take, that an LL Cool J could take back in his day, that a Run DMC could have taken in their day, or that, you know, any popular culture figure could take in their particular moment of extreme popularity, that type of move would help create a different type of public conversation about witnessing versus snitching, which is essential for mobilizing the hip-hop generation and the generation coming up behind it to engage in something a little more responsible.
Dr. Mark Lamont Hill is author of the piece, A Treatise on Snitching, is one of America's leading hip-hop intellectuals and assistant professor of urban education at Temple University. He can be found at marklamonthill.com. We have links to his website and his blog at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.